Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, when The Blind Side first premiered, audiences enjoyed the feel-good story and the film enjoyed extensive critical success. But with recent legal filings from Michael Orr, the subject of the film, we have to grapple with many complications in the legacy of the story. My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, is John Nekrasov. And John, before we get to that and a couple other pretty serious stories, we do need to start, and I don't even want to do any pleasantries. I want to start with you taking on the role of our boots-on-the-ground reporter for a soccer game, a final even, that involved, I think, the person we would both agree to be the undisputed GOAT in the world of soccer. John, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You saw Lionel Messi.
I did, in fact, see Lionel Messi, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. We'll just put it right out there and say it. I got to see Messi come to Nashville, come to Jodis Park, where my hometown team of Nashville Soccer Club plays, and watch my hometown team play against the greatest soccer player to ever grace the face of the earth. And it was insane. It was surreal. The fact that I even made it there was surreal. The fact that I was in the stands as he walked out of the tunnel, and then not only walked out of the tunnel, but scored a classic Messi coming in from the right, curled screamer into the top corner, literally right in front of me, to the fact that we lost on penalties after 11 rounds of penalties, which was devastating. Literally, I can't even begin to sum up what the emotions felt like in that moment, but he was, I don't know, he was incredible. Those are the moments we live for as sports fans. And the fact that, honestly, part of it was surreal, was seeing both Jordi Alba and Sergio Busquets there with him. It felt like something out of my childhood. I saw those guys growing up, 2010, watching them at the World Cup in South Africa and at Barcelona ever since then. And to see them literally in the flesh, in Miami uniforms of all things. It's bizarre for all of us, and obviously that's why tickets have been so insane to even get a hold of, but the opportunity to be there was amazing, and it was a moment I will remember for the rest of my life as just the soccer fan that I am.
Yeah, I want to tie it into maybe the conversations that we've been having about this topic, because we've talked a lot about if and how Messi is going to make a difference for Apple TV Plus and their subscription service. What kind of difference does Messi's presence make in the grounds of a stadium? And obviously this is an away stadium, not Inter Miami's home stadium, but did it feel different from the other Nashville game that you had gone to this year?
I had been to two before that, and it was a completely different experience. To be honest, we've talked about how the TV numbers have increased some, but maybe haven't increased all that much. But let me tell you, when you're in the stadium, it is a transformed experience. You can feel the tension building. Literally a sold out, completely sold out stadium, full to the brims. You have fans from Miami in huge numbers who are cheering. You have fans who clearly are from Nashville and are cheering for Messi anyway. There's literally, whether people are booing him or cheering for him, you feel the whole stadium catch its breath every time he appears. And everyone, at work, everyone I talked to knew about the game. They knew it was going on. Soccer is not Nashville's sport yet, but that weekend soccer became Nashville's sport. It became the thing that everyone was talking about. People were talking about whether they could get tickets. It was just an incredible experience, and it's just a testament to the fact that Messi has elevated the profile of this league in a completely new way.
He elevated the profile of soccer as a whole, obviously. Were there any specific ways that a crowd that would be otherwise very hostile to the opposing superstar were maybe more sympathetic to him given who he was?
I think a little bit, honestly. Because our crowd definitely did boo him a good amount. That definitely happened. But you can feel, especially when he scored, especially after he won the trophy and everything, you can kind of feel he's someone completely different than anything, we've ever seen. I'd never seen someone like that in the flesh, at a Michael Jordan level star of their sport, right? A Tiger Woods, like a Novak Djokovic, like that is a transformative personality. And like when you're watching greatness like that, you can't like, you can't help but applaud ultimately. Like obviously I didn't want to get scored on by him, but like still when it goes in, like what are you supposed to do? You know, I don't know. I know you've seen Zlatan in the flesh, which is, you know, your personal king. And those moments, like even if it's not for your team, there's still like something incredibly, there was something special about that moment. And I guess if you're going to be beat by anyone, it might as well be Bessie, right?
Yeah, it might as well be the guy where you get a lifelong memory either way.
Right,
and one,
exactly.
And one that's not all bad, because you lose to some random Miami team in that final, all you feel is, oh, that's really sad. But
like if he had gotten injured in like the first 10 minutes and then Miami won anyway, that's the worst possible outcome. But as it was, I got to see the GOAT do GOAT things, and I highly recommend it.
It's awesome. It's very exciting. Let me just take a quick little journey around the world of sports here as we get into it, and we'll kind of go from least serious to more serious. Mm-hmm. Least serious, really quickly, Carlos Alcaraz and Novak Djokovic played in another final. And we are now, as we're recording this, only 6 days away from the beginning, or 7 days away from the beginning of the U.S. Open.
Really?
So, yeah, it is right around the corner. And obviously, we covered extensively Carlos Alcaraz in the Wimbledon final, beating Djokovic. Djokovic has now gotten his revenge in a hard court match in the States. And so, I guess all I'm saying is, fasten your seatbelts and get ready for Wimbledon, because we have a tennis rivalry back. This is the rivalry that everyone wants. This is the one that we were all hoping would happen in the wake of Nadal and Federer not being who they once were or not being in the game at all. And so here we are, and these two guys are ready to meet this moment, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about the U.S. Open here in the next few weeks on the pod. So
yes,
that's just a brief aside.
You watched it, right?
I did watch the final. It was awesome.
I was just going to ask, how does that, like, given what Wimbledon was, like, how did it compare to that? Obviously, it's a lower stakes match, but it's prep for eventually a big tournament for both of them. Like, what did you, as someone who likes to observe tennis a lot, like, what did you see out of that match?
Yeah, I think the two takeaways are, one, no one can dig as deep as Novak Djokovic,
right,
who was losing in this match by a set and a break in the second set, mm-hmm. and rallied to win in three sets, won in a tie break. There is, I think that right now, maybe some other people's floors are better than Novak's. He definitely mm-hmm. can have off days or days where he's just not quite there. But I still think that maybe I don't think his physical ceiling is as high as Carlos, but certainly his mental capacity to dig and grind is so much heightened compared to anybody else. And that maybe that's just an age and experience thing. But obviously he still has that drive to power through that nobody else has. The other thing, and this has been a consistent problem, is that Carlos Alcaraz needs to figure out why his legs keep cramping. They cramped in the French Open final. They cramped again in the third set of this final. And that's just going to be an ongoing issue, I think, until he figures out what's going on there. And either he needs to get that fixed or he needs to be able to work around it, because that's now two finals out of three against Djokovic where he's had this issue pop up, where he's been not even physically at his best. When to play Djokovic, you have to be both physically and mentally at your best.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely huge, and it's interesting. I hope they meet again in the U.S. Open. It kind of feels like they're gonna have to keep meeting, because no one else is at their level right now in reality. But it'll be good to see them go back to a five-set format and see, because I was surprised. You know, we kind of really thought that Novak couldn't be like outlasted by Carlos. At least I didn't. And then Carlos demonstrated, you know, in between these two matches that he could. You know, he went the distance over five with Novak, which is a remarkable thing to do. So we'll see what happens with this upcoming tournament, but I'm definitely super excited. I unfortunately don't think anyone else is going to win it.
No, it's going to be one of those two. Moving on to baseball for a second here, and we're going to talk about this story more when we get more information. This is just to say we are aware of it, but Wander Franco, who is a star player for the Tampa Bay Rays, has been placed on administrative leave by the Major League Baseball. I don't know if you saw this story, John, but he is being investigated by Major League Baseball and also the government of the Dominican Republic for his relationships with underage girls. There is one girl who has come publicly forward and has posted pictures of her with Wander on social media. And a separate woman who is currently anonymous has actually made a complaint to the government and the police in the Dominican Republic about this issue. Administrative leave is a 14-day kind of placeholder ruling by Major League Baseball. It can be appealed by the union, and it just kind of is going to be a time where he's going to be away from the team as this continues to be investigated. And when we hear more, I'm sure we'll be able to talk about it more. But obviously, a troubling situation, even from the little bit so far that we know.
Right. And am I right in remembering that he was close to a pretty big contract? Is that right? It's like I heard that somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, he would be, I think, arguably one of the two or three best players on the Rays. He came up, I saw him play in Durham when he was here. He's come up through the system. He's been a Ray for quite a while, and I think he is approaching a contract here, maybe even this next summer. So right. It's going to be big to see what happens here, but obviously a troubling situation regardless.
For sure, no doubt. And kind of tied into a story that's kind of equally troubling and is kind of nearing the conclusion of a saga that has been, I don't know, at least been going on for a year over in the soccer world.
Is that longer?
Longer than a year when Mason Greenwood was first announced?
Mason Greenwood's last game for Manchester United was January of 2022.
Has it really been that long?
Yes.
That's insane. But yeah, I mean, so just for some background on that, I can't remember if we talked about it on the pod back when this actually news broke. I think we did. But Mason Greenwood was one of the most promising young stars in English soccer, and I believe was around age 20, I guess, at the time, and really was one of the brightest, not only stars just in English soccer, but specifically for United. And allegations came out that he got arrested, and then allegations came out that he had attempted to rape and assault and coerce his girlfriend at the time. And he was obviously dropped from the team while the investigation was ongoing. Finally, this March or February, the criminal charges against him were dropped, and then United began an investigation internally kind of into what they were going to do with him. And so we've kind of got an update to that story now that has just been, you know, we've talked a lot about these stories of athletes engaging in abuse or alleged abuse. And the story kind of repeats itself every time. We talked about it with Trevor Bauer, talked about it with Deshaun Watson, obviously. And this is just another example of kind of a situation where the criminal trials don't reach a full conclusion, you know, one way or the other, and the charges are dropped or things are settled. And so we're kind of left with the question of what does the team do? And that's kind of what brought us to this point where we are now.
Yeah, I think a lot of my discomfort continues to be around the fact that he was not formally charged, or if he was, that the charges were dropped, because the woman who was originally filed the complaint against Mason Greenwood dropped her complaint or was uncooperative with the police going forward. From my understanding, Mason Greenwood is still together with this woman, and they actually have a child now, so he's actually a father now. So I think that, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that he is still together with the same woman. Okay. So it'll be, I mean, it's just an interesting situation. I think we could talk about it for Mason, we could talk about it for United, we could talk about it from a lot of different angles, and we certainly should talk about how United has handled this. But I think, I want you to help me with this, John, because I have an impulse, and I'm not sure if it's the right one, but my impulse is that when a team makes a decision that is different from the decision made by the court of law or the legal proceedings, I instinctively want to know why. I instinctively want to know what United found that the court didn't find, or what information they had gathered from the witness that the witness was not willing to share with law enforcement. Or maybe it's just a matter of the burden of proof. And in the court of law, you have to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. And when it comes to a team decision, it's just more, it's just, and you can be dismissed for any type of cause. Maybe it's just that. But whether it's this situation or the Deshaun Watson situation, I just feel like when a decision is made that is different from the one that has been formally announced by law, by the court of law who decide these matters, then I just instinctively want to know why. And maybe it would be a violation of the victim's privacy for me to know why. And if that's the case, I obviously don't deserve or have any right to know. But for them to say, we know something that the police don't know, and for that reason, we're going to make a different decision, it leaves me very curious about what is going on in this situation, because as far as we can tell, the woman, the victim, did not want the police to move forward with prosecuting Mason Greenwood for whatever reason. And I don't know what that reason is, but there was one.
Right. So this is where we get into the corporate politics of what goes on behind the scenes. And we never really know, but this is a story, right, that happens with any large organization, right? When you have a PR issue, you have to decide, you know, how you're going to deal with this. So I think it's important to go over what United just did. So United did finish their investigation and announced that they were going to bring Mason back. That was something that was going to happen, that he was going to be able to rejoin the team. They concluded that that with the charges dropped, that they didn't find any evidence that a rape happened, basically. And Adam Crafton of The Athletic did great work kind of researching this and telling this story, kind of the whole behind the scenes. But they announced that decision, and then over, I guess, this weekend, there was just an immense amount of backlash that happened from abuse organizations, from potentially from some players on the women's team for United, obviously from journalists, lots of people, lots of fans. And so United did an about face this weekend and said, no, actually, he's not, we're not going to terminate him, because they didn't find any extra information that made them think that he could be terminated for cause, basically, that his contract could be terminated. So what they did is they said, essentially, they put out a statement that said, the optics of this mean that he should not play for us. But we will help him find another team, more out of the spotlight. And I think that's where we get into kind of the nitty gritty of this, is that they really didn't say they found different information that kept him off the team. They literally just said, the optics of this are bad, and we're just going to kind of roll with it, and go with what the public wants. But after trying to bring him back, right? I don't know. That just makes me uncomfortable. It's the same situation with the Browns.
Yeah. I don't think Manchester United as an executive board should be the ultimate determiner of facts when it comes to whether or not the situation happened.
For sure.
But if, and this is the huge, huge if it is true, as United said, that Mason did not commit the offense that he was charged for, then United have made a terrible decision, in my opinion. And I understand that you're going to get blowback, and there are people who will not believe that this didn't happen, no matter what the evidence is, or other causes may believe that. But again, if that statement is true, if it could be found to be true that Mason did not commit the offense, then why is he? I don't understand why he's leaving. If it is just because of the blowback, that I think that's a cowardly decision by the club. If they genuinely don't believe that he did anything wrong, then there's no reason. Then it's wrong to punish him for an offense that he did not commit, for a lot of reasons. One of which is because it shows people that that if an accusation becomes something that gets someone fired, then lots of lives of famous people can be ruined for any reason. And that's obviously a thing that we don't want in our society, that an accusation is guilt, and that anyone who is accused of something loses their job just because they've been accused of it. But also because United did the work of actually trying to find out. And if the decision was going to be made based on public opinion, then we didn't need this long, drawn-out process. if the facts of the matter were going to be irrelevant to the ultimate decision, and if he was going to leave, whether or not he was found to be to have committed this offense, then why draw it out? Why even bother? The idea that you went through this whole process only to, in your opinion, find him to be not responsible, and then still have him leave the club, then I don't understand that. That's a situation where, with all due sensitivity to people who are real victims of domestic abuse and the obvious sensitivities around this issue, I do think that is the wrong example of bowing to popular opinion if what is right is something different than what the public thinks. And part of what United need to do, and part of why I want to know the evidence, is because I think the public have a right to actually know what happened here.
Right. Well, I think part of the problem is, right, that there are public videos that were released, that leaked, of an incident happening, right? So that the optics of that don't go away, right? We do have that at least on file. And their claim is that in the broader context of what they saw in what happened, that it wasn't a criminal offense, right? Which would be fireable. But they still, I think, my view is that they still view that as behavior that shouldn't represent the club in terms of what happened. And I think that's understandable, but like, you shouldn't go back on the decision. That's the problem. I think you're right that there is, they made a call and then in the face of withering criticism, reversed it. If you actually believe that that's behavior not worthy of your club representatives, right? Then, you know, you need to say that from the beginning. Otherwise it does feel, as we've talked about many times, that you just, you literally took a stance just because people told you to and not because you actually believed it was right. If you think that there is a hard line against certain types of behavior that's borderline abusive, maybe, even if it's not abusive in a court of law, then maybe you need to set that standard from the beginning. And if you only believe that just because other people told you to, then that's not really your stance to begin with, right? It's dishonest. And so I think you're right in that, like, we do have a lot of circumstances like this where we're kind of left in the lurch as the public. We don't know the facts here, and United won't give us the facts because they're a club trying to cover up for their own PR, right? Just like all of these teams, they want the least amount of facts out and given to the public as possible, because the more facts that are out, the worse it makes them look. So they're always trying to minimize the damage of the fact that one of their representatives is behaving in this manner, right? But you're still, there are still consequences for those team decisions when they are not transparent.
Yeah, let me just be clear. Mason does say in his statement that he acknowledges that there, that he made some sort of ambiguous mistake in his relationship.
Right.
And the club said that they have been provided with an alternative explanation for the audio recording, and that the woman's family has participated in the process, and because of that, they're convinced that Mason did not commit the acts that he was charged for. Charged for, obviously, in a legal setting, refers to criminally charged for. If the club's statement, if the club's position is, we have a zero tolerance policy for any sort of wrongdoing in a relationship, whether or not it reaches the threshold of criminal, that is 100% fine. Right. And that is 100% a fine thing to do. And in that case, if Mason agrees that he committed wrongdoing, he should go. But I would, even if we don't know the specifics about the relationship between Mason Greenwood and his girlfriend, I would like to know what United standard is, or what, if the Premier League makes it, like, the,
for sure.
To be clear, like, the NFL has a domestic policy standard.
Right.
That is not based on the legal court of law, but is an actual standard. And I would love to know what the standard, the objective standard is, of which Mason Greenwood would be in violation of. And I think my biggest frustration is not that Mason Greenwood won't be at United anymore. I do think it would be, he would be a hard person to cheer for at this point, or support at this point. And I don't think I'm sad that he's leaving, but I'm just confused by what this whole thing was all about. If the video and audio recording out of context alone were going to be enough to cause him to leave the club, whether or not he committed a crime, in part because of the public optics and in part because he acknowledges that he committed some sort of wrongdoing, then we could have known that like a year ago. Like, I don't understand what this investigation was all about. If everyone was going to agree that Mason did something wrong, it was not criminal, and he's going to leave anyway, then that seems like something that doesn't require an in-depth investigation. That sounds like something that everyone just acknowledges this is what happened, and he leaves. And the whole drawn-outness of this process is very baffling to me. Obviously, the flip-flop is something that you've talked about well, and obviously that's a... It's obvious when we're dealing with what is an obvious cover up that it's a horrible situation. We talked about it just recently with the Northwestern University, where they, you know, they're sitting on this information they don't think is going to come out, and then the cover up is necessary because they weren't transparent. This is obviously an even worse type of cover up because they're the ones who actually set themselves up for it by actually saying that he was going to come back, and now he's not. Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, this whole situation is very sad, and it's very difficult to even talk about with how little we know due to what United will not and probably should not tell us to respect the privacy of the victim. But it leaves me once again with more questions than answers about how this sport and how all sports are going to objectively tackle issues of domestic issues that, one, give the benefit of the doubt and support for victims and is not based on the court of law, but two, doesn't allow for defamation or slander against athletes without any factual basis to ruin their careers, as is what someone like Trevor Bauer is alleging in his multiple defamation suits against the women who are accusing him of things. And again, we don't know the ultimate story of that either. But when these athletes are so adamant that they are not doing something, and the people even agree that they did not do what they are charged with, then it just, there doesn't seem to be a solution here that protects both victims and athletes from false allegations.
Right. I mean, so another example of this is the case of Benjamin Mendy, ex, I believe at this point, Manchester City footballer.
Yeah.
Who was on trial for many counts of rape, mm-hmm. From many women. He was, I believe, cleared, or the charges were dropped in every single case.
Yeah.
I don't know how far all of the cases actually went, but regardless, there are no longer any charges against him. And people were very upset because of the amount of support he received from other footballers in the wake of that case being resolved. There were a lot of people that were frustrated that it seemed like here's a man with just a wide, you know, a rap sheet as long as Deshaun Watson's of accusations against him. He's cleared of them. And then all like players from across the entire European football community all come out saying, like, essentially, look at how people have pilloried this guy with accusations without any actual proof and just destroyed his life and his career. And that's something that these players are concerned about. And, you know, I think it's natural for us in our current cultural climate as people, you know, who are, you know, very firmly against domestic abuse and against abuse that is, you know, to a vast majority perpetrated by men, that, you know, we naturally want to increase justice for the women who are victims of those men, right? And so the media opinion, because those issues are covered up a lot of times by men, is something that's really important, right? But it is also important to remember, as you're saying, that there are two sides to this story in all of these circumstances. And there are a lot of footballers, whether justified or unjustified, who have a different opinion in view of how all of these very high profile cases are happening. And as a result, it's important to talk about, right? Because there are situations that do happen where people have false accusations brought against them, right? And in a lot of these cases, you know, without getting into a lot of the details, they are very messy stories where incidents do happen, but maybe they're not at the level that, you know, that alleged victims are alleging, right? And so when you're dealing with these kind of he said, she said situations, right, it is hard to know. And so it's important to represent both sides when we don't have all the facts.
Yeah, I think the Mendy situation kind of speaks to the type of clarity that I'm looking for, because mm-hmm. he did go to trial twice, actually. He went to trial two different times. and was found not guilty by two separate juries. In an instance where, again, in this case, and in the case of like the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial or the O.J. Simpson trial, if nothing else, the evidence is made public and reasonable people look at the evidence and make a decision, and we all understand. There's obviously a huge amount of debate about the O.J. Simpson trial. People believe the jury made the wrong decision. The Depp v. Heard trial, very controversial. The Benjamin Money trial, similarly controversial, had to go to a retrial because the jury was hung on two of the charges at the first, and so they had to go to a second trial where he was found not guilty. But if nothing else, juries are not the perfect arbiter of justice either. They're not infallible. But at least the evidence is out there, and reasonable people can look at it and make a decision. I have every reason to think that the people involved in the investigation at Manchester United were reasonable people looking at the evidence. But there's no transparency. And I remember bringing up transparency specifically in the Deshaun Watson situation, or again in the Trevor Bauer situation, where he's actually just tweeting out screenshots of things. He's just going on Twitter and just posting screenshots of conversations to try to exonerate himself. And I just think that in situations like this, if we don't have enough evidence to actually have an understanding of what's going on, then it's just going to lead to more confusion. And the lack of a clear policy by Manchester United in terms of domestic abuse is something that the NFL took way too long to make. But like I said, they finally made one. And if nothing else, you can go read the policy. And if someone is suspended by the NFL's domestic violence policy, you can go read it. And you can say, okay, one of those things happened, and they are bad. Mm-hmm. But well, we know nothing here. And it's just very frustrating to me.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's just important to say, like, we have these circumstances that do happen, like with Mendy. And sometimes people getting cleared doesn't mean that they're not scumbags.
Of course not.
Right. And I think that's like just important to underline here. Like the behavior that Benjamin Mendy showed, you know, that did happen. Right. That was admitted, may not have been criminal, but these people are still like kind of awful people sometimes.
Yeah.
That are in these cases, right? And even if they don't make it to the point, like with Deshaun, where people are willing to go all the way to trial and, you know, get through all these situations, like there's no doubt in my mind that Deshaun is a scumbag, right? Like that's not going to change. And the NFL clearly thought so and ended up suspending him, right? And we can all argue about how much it, you know, much people should be suspended and all that stuff. But I think you're right that there was a degree of clarity that eventually happened with Deshaun's case, right? We got a degree of facts from the NFL, and here we just don't really have anything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's a tough thing for the soccer side of Manchester United. He was a very good player. It looks like looks like he might be going to Saudi Arabia.
That's not. I mean, I could make a lot of jokes about that, but
yeah,
we'll leave that there.
Which is seems like just the most on brand thing for Saudi Arabia. Regardless, it's a very very difficult situation, and we hope that we continue to highlight these and hopefully just get a better understanding of how to protect all the important people involved in this situation. Because as we've said many times. When we started this podcast, I don't think we expected to do most of our podcasts about domestic violence. And yet, here we are, John, where it's just every third or fourth one, it's going to be something to do with these kind of incidents. And it's just completely tragic. And we hate it, but here we are.
Yeah. And we've got our big topic for the day is another story that is also just, it's a different legal situation. But again, it's a messy legal situation where we don't really have a lot of facts, and yet we're just left kind of squeamish, honestly.
Yeah, this is a situation that is going to be decided in the court of law.
It most certainly will.
So I think that this is going to be something that's going to be covered extensively. If there is a civil trial, it might be on television. We're going to understand what the facts are by the time we get to the bottom of this. And what we're talking about is the controversy involving Michael Orr and the Tui family, most famously depicted in the widely acclaimed movie The Blind Side, which 14 years ago was a smash hit. I remember my mom taking me to the theaters to see that 14 years ago. It was a huge thing. Sandra Bullock was the headliner of this movie. It's about a African-American minor, a kid who is, according to the movie, adopted by a white family and given a home, and goes on to an incredible football career spanning high school, college, professionally. And it certainly is a feel-good movie in which the troubled teen is supported by a loving and happy family who want to encourage and support him, and he goes on to great things. But as with many good stories, it's really not as good as it seemed, at least according to Michael Orr, who has made several fairly ambiguous comments about his opinion of the movie in the past. Mm-hmm. But now we are getting an extensive legal filing from Michael Orr with serious allegations, including that the Tui family never formally adopted him, but rather tricked him into signing what is a conservatorship. Which a conservatorship is probably most famous due to the fact that Britney Spears was famously in one for a very, very long time, in which you're basically signing away a lot of the controlling decisions involving your money to another person. He alleges that he never received any of the profits from the movie The Blind Side that went to the Tui family, and the Tui family apparently all received, according to the lawsuit, quite a bit of money, and he never saw a bit of it. Yeah, I want you to jump in here, John. You did some homework for this podcast, and I would love to get your fresh eyes on what you thought about the original movie and then kind of where we stand now. And I think this is going to be the first of many, many podcasts we do on this subject as the mm-hmm. as the legal proceedings and the documents start to pile in here.
Yeah, we're doing a special thing here and putting on both our film critic hats and our sports hats simultaneously for this segment. I did my homework and, you know, I did not grow up in a football household, so I did not watch The Blind Side growing up. And I watched it last night before we recorded. And let's just start off from the top about the movie, like you said. On the face of it, it's a feel-good movie, like you said, about a, you know, nice white family adopting a nice but quiet and somewhat slow black kid who mm-hmm. is an athletic star. And the first thing that Orr has kind of made ambiguous comments that he didn't really like throughout the last few years was the fact that he didn't really like the fact that he was portrayed as slow and unable to pick up the sport of football. He took offense to that, and the fact that the movie kind of claims that Sandra Bullock, i.e. Leanne Tui, teaches him to play football, essentially, and he alleges this is not true at all, which to my mind makes perfect sense.
Yeah, your average suburban housewife is not exactly a savant of the game.
Right, and it's also hilarious, a fact that you wouldn't necessarily know from watching this movie, but the coach of the real school where Michael Orr played was in fact Hugh Freeze, who is, you know, for all the controversy that surrounded Hugh Freeze over the years, is most certainly not a stupid coach.
He recently came out with a statement in support of the Tui family.
Mm-hmm. I was somewhat surprised, to be honest, that Hugh Freeze was happy with his portrayal in The Blind Side to begin with, because having been around him, he's, you know, at least now is a relatively nice guy, but I cannot imagine him just being told off by some random mom on the sidelines and being particularly happy about it, because he seems to know what he's talking about. So that, you know, point A,
yeah,
that was a little, the football stuff, a little weird. Point B, I am not a movie policer. I don't go around and try to find all the little ideological things in movies that I don't like and be like, oh, well, you just portrayed this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, and this made me mad. I really try not to do that. I try to, you know, watch a movie from the filmmaker's perspective. That being said, this movie may have been the worst example of white saviorism that I've ever seen in my life in a film. And I've seen, like, actively racist films from the 50s and 60s. Right, that are like actively patronizing toward anyone of other ethnicities that is not white. Right, this is like you pretend to run away from that, right, and pretend like it's this like high and mighty story, and then you just have some of the most awkward like patronizing situations that could possibly happen. And I don't know, it just made me very angry. There's some dialogue that like I don't even like necessarily want to quote on here, but like there were some lines of dialogue where I was just like, I was in shock that it was considered okay and like Oscar worthy 14 years ago.
Mm.
Things that like I cannot imagine being in the room with someone and them saying about someone of another ethnicity and being like, oh, that was totally normal. And it's just, Sandra Bullock won Best Actress for this. This movie was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Like, this is the Oscars we're talking about here, mm-hmm. right? Like, the bastion of woke liberalism that everyone rails about. It was just like, I don't know. Leaving aside the entire storyline of whether legally the Tuohys took advantage of Michael Orr, this film, it just... It's like feel good, but like with a veneer of patronizing of someone who really did kind of, as far as I understand, kind of raise himself up by his own bootstraps with help from them, you know, but I mean, he learned his craft from the football field and became successful. And here we have a very different story.
Yeah, I think that there have been some projects recently that have kind of grappled with this, with the idea of multicultural families. Mm-hmm. Colin Kaepernick has recently been kind of grappling with his own adoption and his parents whom he loves and will always love, but whom he has some problems with, you know, some just either ignorances or aggressions that they had toward him, and just kind of the difficulties of bridging a ethnic and cultural divide in a family. And you know, I don't know how Colin Kaepernick's parents feel about the way that Colin has talked about them recently. They seem to be supportive of their son, but he's open about the fact that there were some, you know, just ways that they weren't speaking on the same page, or things that they may or may not have known were causing him hurt, and they did. This movie, as far as it portrays the Tuohys, goes to a level of some racial insensitivity that it's hard to imagine that the parents, if they truly were his parents, of an African American boy would not be aware were insensitivities.
I would hope so.
Like, there's a very, very basic level of just humanity when you think about what it would be like to raise a black son that is just, even in the very generous portrayal of the Tuohys in The Blind Side, just reaches the level of, come on, like, what are you doing here? And again, that's a very generous portrayal of the Tuohys as the way the movie is portrayed. And secondly, yeah, the theme of the movie is bizarre, because I don't think you could argue that there is a single NFL player who made the NFL because of his family situation. That's just not how the NFL works, right? Like, there are so many people who want to be professional athletes that anyone who makes it make it because they did the work and did it.
Right, exactly.
No one can be adopted into a situation that gets them into the NFL. And the Tuohys do seem to get a lot of credit in the movie for Michael Orr's success. And certainly in ways that they could have supported him financially or helping him navigate the college admissions process in maybe a way that a different situation would not have been aware of. They certainly were helpful. There's no doubt that having people who have gone to college and know how the college application process, know how to navigate interviews, are financially stable, all of that matters. But Michael Orr was an NFL player because Michael Orr had the talent and put in the work to be an NFL player. There's no question about it. And as much as the thematic elements of the movie can be frustrating, nothing to me is more frustrating than if it's true that he did not make any money off this movie. If that is true, as he alleges, that is one of the great injustices I've seen in quite a long time. According to his attorneys, each member of the Tuohy family, the four members of the Tuohy family who are white and who are biologically related, all made equal shares of the movie, and he made nothing. The Tuohys dispute that very, very vigorously, and ultimately the court is going to decide that. If that is true, that is a shocking thing to happen. And if it is not true, it'll be an interesting question why. So far, the biggest defense the Tuohys have issued, and this is really interesting to me, the Tuohys' lawyer has said that Michael Orr has tried to bring this lawsuit several times, but has not been able to get an attorney to take the case, because once attorneys look at the case, they see that Michael Orr has no evidence to back up his claims and drop out. And that this is like the third or fourth legal team that Michael Orr has gone to, and he finally found a team that's willing to take the case. That's an interesting defense, and if that's true, obviously I think Michael Orr could have some difficulty here proving what he's alleging, if that is the case. But again, the optics are bad, I think mostly for the Tui family, because they're the ones here forced to defend themselves. But it also has, I think, brought about a much needed reflection on a much loved but quite problematic movie, that even if all of these allegations by Michael Orr are false and defamatory against the Tui family, is still, I think, a movie that has not aged well, just to put it lightly.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting situation, because we don't have, this has just happened, we don't have the facts yet at all right now about what actually happened here. The Tuis allege, along with Michael Lewis of podcasting and sports writing fame, who, among other things, wrote the book Moneyball, which then inspired the major motion picture Moneyball, as well as this movie.
And The Big Short.
Yep. He alleges, along with the Tuis, that that basically he split money. Obviously, Orr is not suing Michael Lewis, but he alleges Lewis has kind of spoken out and said he split the movie revenue, which he claims was not a lot when they sold the movie rights from the book. And he took half, I think, and the Tuis took half and split it among the five of them. And that's what the Tuis allege as well. So important to note that, like you said, because the facts are not out. It's a messy situation, right? And clearly there was kind of a rupture between Orr and the Tui family in the last decade or so. I just feel like the like you said, the movie is just so odd, because ultimately it's the story not of, it is a story of a family taking on a son. And I want to be clear. There are people who claim that adoption, like multicultural adoption, is always white saviorism, and that it's a bad idea and that it's unhelpful to people. I will never say that. I don't think that's true. I know many families where that is not the case personally. And I really think that people who say that don't know what they're talking about. There obviously are circumstances where that does happen, but, you know, choosing to love someone as a person, regardless of whether they're your race or not, you know, you're still choosing to care for them, right? Like, it's not, if you make it about everything about the person's race, right? Like, you're putting a divide between people who are ultimately both just people, right?
Certainly.
So I think it's important to note that, and I don't think that should be a part of this conversation, but in this specific instance, it's remarkable to me how this movie was made, and if the Tui family really cared for Michael as much as they kind of claim they do, it's hard to imagine this movie being made. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, it is a movie basically about Sandra Bullock creating a football player. You know? And I just don't think that, like you said, that's just, one, not realistic, and two, takes so much credit away from the work of that player. You know, like, family situations can absolutely create the platform for you to succeed. That's just how life is, right? Like, your family puts so much into who you are as a person. But no one, it's not like the family is the football player. Like, ultimately, the story is about you, right? And if he wasn't even, like, consulted for the story, if he was actually completely signed away the rights to his story, like he claims he did accidentally without someone telling him, like, that's just kind of reprehensible. And the fact is, it's not alleged, he did sign himself into a conservatorship, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we do know that, and the Tuis have said they'll terminate it, like, they agree to mutually terminate it, which is just kind of like, you're like in a contract with your family. It's just kind of like, it's just a strange situation. You can absolutely adopt adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when has that been terminated, or it will
not
be
yet,
terminated?
I think the Tuis have publicly said that they are willing to terminate it, though. So,
yeah, I mean, that whole idea that kind of came to light with like Britney Spears is just weird that like these adults in their 30s and 40s are not able to make financial decisions for themselves because they're in conservatorships. That's obviously just a weird situation either way. And yeah, I definitely want to echo what you said that, you know, people who adopt are heroes. They really are. Yeah. They're mm-hmm. absolutely doing an incredible thing. I guess my only thing is that when you are adopting multi-ethnically, there is a level of self-education you have to take on with that. For sure. And this movie script is completely devoid of that education. And whether or not that reflects the way that the Tui household was, I don't know. But as the movie portrays the Tuis, there obviously is a lack of understanding how to navigate a multicultural adoption. Although we agree it can be and often is successfully navigated. Mm. Because you've seen it more recently, the headline of this story is Michael Orr was not actually adopted, because that was like the thing of the movie. Mm-hmm. How does the movie handle the adopt? Like, it is very clear that he is adopted, right? Like,
so they actually, from what I remember, they never say that he's adopted. They say that she's going to become his legal guardian.
Okay.
Right. That the parents are becoming his legal guardian. So they do actually say that. The words, as far as I remember, I could be wrong, but as far as I remember, having just watched it, the words adoption are never used. They just say legal guardians, and you're now part of this family. Which is interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And the scene that stood out to me the most from that movie, which is definitely not what this movie intended, the scene that stood out to me most was the scene where the NCAA investigator takes Michael into a big giant boardroom and starts questioning him about whether his parents adopted him. I don't think she used the word adopt either, but she may have, I can't remember. So that he would sign for Ole Miss. And you're sitting there and you're like, you think about it, and this movie is trying to portray this, it feels like emotionally as this big bad investigator coming to tear this family apart. And when you think about it in light of the facts, it's very awkward, because that scene, which is like sort of at the climax of the movie, turns out to be like kind of the truth. Regardless,
we'll see if it is.
Well, regardless, the Tuis have said that they did the conservatorship so that he could go to Ole Miss and not run into NCAA problems instead of adopting him. That is a public thing that they have said, right? So when you put all those things together, right, it gets a little icky, right? And this random aside with this investigator, who's the antagonist.
Yeah.
The Blind Side.
The big bad bureaucracy.
The big bad bureaucracy maybe was onto something all along. Like, the NCAA was doing something right, and all the money bags in the background were like, oh, no, don't ask any questions. Don't, there's nothing to see here. I don't know if you remember that scene, but like that scene stuck out to me the most out of the entire movie. And it was, that and one other scene at the end. but it was just uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite a while since I've seen the movie. The movie means a lot to a lot of people. It means a great deal to a lot of people. So either way, it's kind of sad to see this come out so publicly. Regardless of whether or not the buttoned up narrative of The Blind Side was true or not, it obviously,
right, of course,
these are people, and to have their drama brought out in the public is obviously disappointing. But yeah, we'll stay on top of this. Obviously, the Tuis are going to have to file their own responses in court. There are going to be some legally binding allegations made here. And we're going to see what's what here. But it's nice when, instead of having to do pop culture separately, the pop culture is the sports story. I don't think it's ever been as much the story as it is in this episode.
That's very true. I do want to kind of point out, like, this is a strange situation, because the Tuis have so much money, and they have said this is one of the things they've said, is that they're literally rolling in money. Like, their defense to themselves was like, they were rolling in money, and the amount of money they alleged making, they're like, why are we arguing about this? And Michael Orr was a football player in the NFL, mm-hmm. which means he also made a lot of money.
Hopefully, so, like, yeah.
I would assume so, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so.
It's a strange situation where, like, maybe there's more money that actually went under the table than what we know. But it does kind of feel to me like it is very much a case about the optics of the story rather than the money. And if it is about the money, then this is weird.
Yeah, I would think so. Obviously, the rights of the movie is a small amount of money compared to what the family made off of being the family from the blind side, and especially for the wife,
right,
who has gone on a massive like speaking tour and has made significantly more money than she would make from the movie just by being the woman from the movie.
Right.
And yeah, a quick Google search says that Michael Orr made $2 million a year in the NFL. So these are all people who should be fine.
Right.
We would hope.
We would hope.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to see. But yeah, anything else on this story or anything else before we get out of here this week, John?
I think the only thing important to note, speaking of movies that have aged poorly, is I just want to give a special shout out to the DC Comics film Blue Beetle, which has aged just as poorly as The Blind Side, but in a week. I think that's important to note.
Yeah, I have nothing to say because I have not seen the DC movie Blue Beetle. And
that's honestly incredible. I'm so proud of you.
If I will until it comes to
I want to give you a standing ovation. I'm really proud of you.
Thank you. Will you be watching the premiere of Ahsoka in 58 minutes when it comes out?
Is that really in 58 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to catch one episode tonight.
Woo!
Yeah.
Look at you, you're back in.
I may be. I actually don't know if I have Disney Plus right now. I need to figure that out.
Oh.
We'll get to that at a later time.
Some drama. Yeah.
That's fine. To be determined.
Yeah. So whether or not we talk about Ahsoka on the show is going to be entirely up to John.
We will talk about Ahsoka on the show. I will do my very best to make that happen. But whether that's going to happen on today, a Tuesday night, I'm not sure.
Could I go on a very intense and very brief Star Wars diatribe here as we wrap up, or should we actually wrap up? I can save it for next week.
That's what the pod is for.
Okay. My fear. This is my preview. By the time this comes out, episode one will be out of the show, so we'll see.
I think episode two as well.
Oh, sure.
I think it's a two episode premiere. Yeah.
My fear, and I mean this very sincerely, is as someone who has thoroughly invested myself in every single Star Wars live action property as well as the Hallmark animated series Star Wars The Clone Wars.
Correct.
I am deeply worried that I have now been, I guess, forcibly ousted from the Star Wars canon in the sense that I wonder if the level of homework required to enter this show is beyond what even I've done. And if that is the case, then that's a big problem for Star Wars. If someone like me, who has devoted my time to all the movies, all the live action shows, and one of the animated shows, if I get into this show and I'm like, I have no idea who these people are and what's going on, and they're not explaining it to me as if I have not seen Rebels, if Star Wars Rebels is the barrier to entry for this show, then this is a massive problem, and I would just like that to be said.
I think that's fair. I think that's it's a valid concern. I would hope that it's not. I think they would assume that, right? I'm assuming that probably most of the content will be kind of coming straight from The Mandalorian, honestly. That's kind of my guess, given that we already re-met Ahsoka, and there was not much Rebels stuff going on there. That being said, Admiral Thrawn, I believe, will appear in the show, which... I don't know if you ever consumed any Thrawn literature of any kind. So you don't even know who... Admiral Thrawn is like one of the coolest Star Wars characters.
Who is he?
He's like a blue Imperial. He's one of the only aliens that ever rose in the Imperial ranks.
Okay, so this is post-episode 6?
My guess is that he doesn't die in like the collapse of the Empire. Because he's an actual Imperial.
So he's an important person during the original Star Wars trilogy who never appears in one of the movies.
Right. Like, he's an important person post-Clone Wars, basically, is the lore.
Mm.
Okay. Right, because that's the Rebels' time. Because the Rebels' timeline is, right, he's fighting the underground after the Empire takes over.
So right? These are the things that I don't know.
Like, right, because you haven't read Thrawn by Timothy Zahn, which is an excellent book.
Because I'm an average Star Wars fan. And if this show is not for the average Star Wars fan...
Right, but I'm an average Star Wars fan too.
No, you're not. I think that would classify you as a serious Star Wars fan.
I've read like two Star Wars books. Those are the only books I've read.
That doesn't matter. I think watching all 11 movies and four live action shows,
yep.
If that's not more than average. I don't know what, like, I don't know what to say. Like, that is...
I mean, I think it is more than average in terms of, like... But, like, I don't think you're an average Star Wars viewer either, though. That's the thing.
But I'm saying, whatever
you're
I am...
You're selling yourself short. Yeah.
But whatever I am, if they go right. above me, it's a problem.
You've just set yourself as the, as the standard for Star Wars.
I love it.
That's the most ridiculous thing you've ever claimed on this show. Chad literally said, if I don't know it, then I shouldn't be forced to. Maybe you should go read a book.
No, I think that the level of investment that I have done would be completely reasonable to expect that the Hallmark summer blockbuster show by the Lucasfilm Star Wars Enterprise would be catered to someone at my level of investment. That is not too much to ask.
Or maybe you're not invested enough.
If I... Okay, let me just say this. If I'm not invested enough, then Star Wars is going to start losing fans rapidly.
And but they lost... They've been losing fans by investing themselves in stupid stuff that the invested fans don't care about. Star Wars regains fans by investing fans in all the stuff that all the crazies, like the crazies drive the Star Wars box office, Chad. That's where this comes from. Yes, it
That's
is.
Not true.
Yes, it
the
is.
Crazies
episode 9.
High, the crazies give a high floor and a relatively low ceiling. And the same is true as Marvel, as we've seen. Because the ceiling for Marvel is $2 billion. But the floor
right,
is like a quarter of that, as we've seen.
Yeah,
and the same is true for Star Wars. If they start catering to the floor, they're going to plummet, as Marvel
but they,
has
but
done.
But they didn't cater to the floor, and they are still plummeting.
No, they didn't.
That's what I'm saying.
They didn't plummet when they catered to the ceiling. They made many, many billions of dollars off a bad trilogy because at least
yeah,
it had
totally
Luke Skywalker
now.
In it.
But they've completely tanked now. Or they just kept doing it, and now where are we? We're at the rock bottom.
We're like, not for Star Wars. We're at rock bottom.
I don't want to watch another season of The Mandalorian.
That's fine, but
like that show hit rock
Andor,
bottom for me.
Andor required zero investment and was incredible. You didn't
right,
have
well,
to know
that's
what
true.
You didn't have to know what a lightsaber was, and you could watch Andor and be like, man, that's good. That is good stuff. I don't know
right.
what any of this is. What is the Force? But my goodness, Cassian Andor is a cool guy. I'm not saying that this should be that basic, but I'm saying that works. And if it's like you have to watch every hour of Rebels to understand what's going on, it's going to be a problem. That's all I'm saying. And you know I'm right.
No, I really don't. I don't think you are. I think you need to go read Thrawn. I think that needs to be your next. Stop reading whatever Reagan book you're reading and go read Thrawn.
I'm reading The Age of Reagan, The Fall of the Old Liberal Order by Stephen Hayward. It's okay. It's a little biased. He's definitely writing with a very conservative slant, but it's interesting.
Oh, that's nice. I'm proud of you.
Yeah,
I am still reading
you.
American Prometheus.
Love
since
that for
we're doing our reading announcements.
Yeah,
now.
Sure.
I'm stopped castigating you for
why
your reading choices.
I'm 620 something pages in, and I'm almost
done.
I'm
not
done,
that many pages in Oppenheimer,
that's
unfortunately.
Okay. I think that's it for my Star Wars soapbox. I think we're going to make that a weekly segment. Chad's Star Wars soapbox.
See, we bring... I feel like most... Like, there was a time when we had enough, like, actually controversial sports topics where we, like, would actually yell at each other about sports topics. We've kind of, like, left most of those topics behind us as we've, delved.
No one's going to zag and do the domestic violence is fine argument. We're on the same page on most of our
sports
stories.
Neither of us are going to be like, we love Saudi Arabia. We just bring the Star Wars segment back and it's... We're right back.
In many ways, sports have been the great unifier for us as the moral lines become more and more clear.
It's really, I've never even thought about that, but that's really unfortunate. The track of this podcast since we started it has just been like a progressive like collapse of sports. Like we're responsible for this.
We might need to reflect on that in the future. But if it takes your firm belief in the wider Star Wars book canon to get you fired up, then hey, who am I to stand in your
Are
way?
Are we surprised?
I'm off my soapbox. That was it. And I think everyone's going to agree with me.
My brother won't. I'm very confident in that. Necrosoft standing against you.
As Joaquin Phoenix, as Napoleon said in the new Napoleon trailer, I have no problem admitting when I'm wrong. I just never am.
That reminds me of the time when a certain ex-president in a certain school we went to quoted a Bible verse, but the said school's social media account put a Bible verse quote on its page and then said, like, Genesis 3:3, and then quote the president's name. And it was like, as if the president had, like, said the Bible verse. Mm-hmm. And it's that exact energy.
Yeah. I have no problem admitting when I'm wrong. I just never am. I think I'm going to, I love that quote. That's my new life, my life quote.
Totally. That is the motto of podcasters everywhere.
Okay. I think we're out of here. That's a good pod.
I think we should leave. I think we've hurt people's ears.
I hope not. If your ears start bleeding, please do just turn us off. But if they're not, then stay in here for a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to listen to today's pod. We thoroughly enjoyed it, as much as you can enjoy a podcast of this subject matter. And we hope that you did too, or at least were informed or challenged in some way. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with another pod on another topic, presumably a lot of the U.S. Open talk and some other things as well. We'll continue to monitor the stories that we've been talking about this week. And until next time, we hope that you all continue to be well and be safe. And we'll talk to you later.
All right. Cheers, guys.